Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, November 10, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing renegotiating NAFTA, non-national tribunals, and the Constitution. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Alvaro Santos, Professor of Law at the Georgetown University Law Center, and John Herman, Partner at Kelly Dry & Warren LLP. Our moderator today is Dan B. Pickard, Partner at Wiley Rhine LLP. I will turn it over now to our able moderator to get us started. After our discussion, we will move to an audience Q&A. Speakers, thank you for joining us. Dan, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Wes. This is Dan Pickard from Wiley Rhine. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today for what I'm sure is going to be a very interesting discussion of connection with NAFTA and international tribunals. As I believe everybody on this call is aware, Chapters 11 and 19 of NAFTA provide for international tribunals with authority to adjudicate disputes on a wide range of subjects, including anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases, expropriation, and discriminatory treatment of NAFTA investors. Supporters of such international tribunals state that these chapters provide for efficient and impartial dispute resolution. However, others have raised concerns regarding the lack of judicial review by U.S. courts, as well as issues connected with certain basic notions of national sovereignty. In this teleforum, we'll discuss the merits and problems of non-national tribunals and their central role in the current discussions related to the renegotiation of NAFTA. So I'd like to briefly introduce our speakers. First is John Herman, who's a partner in Washington, D.C., at Kelly, Dry & Warren, where he is a member of the firm's International Trade and Customs Practice. Prior to returning to Kelly, Dry in May 2009, Mr. Herman served in the administration of President George W. Bush, including in assignments as the Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director of International Trade, Energy, and Environment on the staff of the National Security Council, and as an senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Import Administration at the U.S. Department of Commerce. Mr. Herman also served as a law clerk to former Chief Judge Gregory Carman at the U.S. Court of International Trade from 1996 to 1998, as well as serving as a legal intern to the chairman of the U.S. International Trade Commission in 1995. Mr. Herman began his career at the White House, serving from 1991 to 1993 as the executive assistant to the assistant to the president for economic and domestic policy. We're also fortunate enough to have Professor Santos as one of our speakers. Alvaro Santos is professor of law and director of the Center for the Advancement of the Rule of Law in the Americas at Georgetown University. He teaches and writes in the area of international trade, economic development, drug policy, transnational labor law, and the future of NAFTA. Professor Santos is co-editor of Law on the New Development State, the Brazilian Experience in Latin America, and the New Law on Economic Development, a Critical Appraisal. He's also the author of a number of articles and book chapters, including Carving Out Policy Autonomy for Developing Countries in the WTO, The Experience of Brazil and Mexico, published in the Virginia Journal of International Law, as well as three transnational discourses of labor law and domestic reforms published by the University of Pennsylvania Journal of International Law. In 2016, he contributed to a research manifesto authored by a working group at the Harvard Institute for Global Law and Policy, examining the role of law in global value chains. Professor Santos serves on the editorial boards of the American Journal of Comparative Law, the Journal of International Economic Law, and Law and Development Review, as well as the Latin American Journal of International Trade Law. He regularly teaches at Georgetown's WTO Academy and Harvard's Institute for Global Law and Policy. He's also taught at the University of Texas, Tufts University, Melbourne Law School, and the University of Turin. Professor Santos received a JD with high honors from the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México and an LLM and SJD from Harvard Law School. And with that, Mr. Herman, if you'd be so kind as to start us off.
Well, thanks, Dan. I appreciate the kind introduction, and it's a pleasure to be able to join you and everyone listening today. So I thought I would cover three topics in my remarks this afternoon. First is providing a quick overview of Chapter 19 and how it came into force. Second is offering some thoughts on why Chapter 19 has been and continues to be controversial. And then finally, wrapping up with a quick summary of the Trump administration's position on Chapter 19 in the ongoing negotiations to revise the North American Free Trade Agreement. And obviously happy to answer questions at the end of everybody's remarks as well. I guess just to start us off, Chapter 19 refers to Chapter 19 of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which provides for the establishment of binational panels to resolve disputes between the parties relating to anti-dumping and countervailing duty determinations made by national authorities. So for those of you listening today who, unlike us, don't spend the majority of your waking hours on the trade laws, anti-dumping duties are imposed where a product is found to be sold in a market at unfairly low prices. I guess I should say an imported product is found to be sold at unfairly low prices. Those duties are imposed in the United States following affirmative determinations by the U.S. Department of Commerce and the United States International Trade Commission. And similar national authorities exist in Canada and Mexico that make similar findings and impose duties. Countervailing duties, in turn, are duties that are imposed to offset foreign subsidies that benefit products imported into a NAFTA country, and again are imposed following affirmative final findings by the Department of Commerce and the U.S. International Trade Commission. So, typically, administrative determinations involving the imposition of dumping and countervailing duties are subject to jurisdiction by U.S. federal courts, specifically the federal district court with jurisdiction over those issues is the United States Court of International Trade, which is a special Article III court that has jurisdiction over appeals involving administrative determinations by the Departments of Commerce and the International Trade Commission, also has jurisdiction over customs-related matters. But it's a special Article III court that sits in Manhattan. Jurisdiction over appeals from decisions by the Court of International Trade are vested with the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit here in Washington, D.C., and in the event that a decision by the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit involving trade law remedy issues is appealed, in certain rare instances, cases have gone on to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the Chapter 19 process essentially removes those cases from the federal court system to be adjudicated by binational panels. In terms of the background and how this provision came into force, both Canada in the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement negotiations and Mexico and Canada in the negotiations on NAFTA both pursued objectives with the United States seeking to affect the continued application of the U.S. anti-dumping and countervailing duty laws to imports entering the United States from Canada and Mexico. The U.S. government declined to make any special accommodations to its unfair trade laws with respect to NAFTA imports. And as a result, there was an agreement under the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement in 1989 that was subsequently extended to Mexico in NAFTA in 1994 that established a unique process for the review of AD/CVD determinations by panels composed of private individuals from each country. In the United States, the U.S. Trade Representative's office is responsible for filling the roster, and it consists of a 75-person roster, well, I guess 25 of which are U.S.-designated individuals. The roster in total contains 75 persons. And for dispute panels, five panelists are selected. Two individuals are picked by each government involved in the dispute, and the fifth is selected either by agreement or by lot. Panelists are not required to be lawyers, but a majority of a panel must be lawyers in good standing in their respective countries. Typically, what you'll see often on the U.S. side, frankly, is practitioners in the area or former practitioners or in some instances former judges will be identified as potential panelists. The appeals may be filed directly with the NAFTA Secretariat. Or appeals may also be removed from U.S. courts. So if there is a dispute involving a AD/CVD determination in the United States involving Mexican goods or Canadian goods, there is the opportunity for parties to file appeals at the Court of International Trade. But if any party wishes to have it removed, it is removed and put into the Chapter 19 process. So under Chapter 19, panels are to apply the same standard that a federal court would apply, making panels responsible for the direct interpretation of U.S. law, and rendering decisions without the benefit of a judicial position. Panels have the authority to remand agency determinations for further proceedings, either at the Department of Commerce or International Trade Commissions. And panel decisions are binding and more or less unreviewable under the terms agreed to in the NAFTA. While there is the possibility of requesting that a panel decision, a Chapter 19 panel decision, be reviewed by an extraordinary challenge committee or an ECC, review is available under only very limited circumstances that include gross misconduct, bias by the panelists or a panelist, breach of fundamental procedures, or a panel taking an action that manifestly exceeds its authority. And in addition, in order for there to be review by an ECC, it must also be established that the panel decision threatens the integrity of the binational panel review process. The ECC, in turn, has authority to either remand panel decisions, dismiss the decision and entrust the case to a new panel, finally, it can simply affirm the panel decision. ECCs consist of three panelists, one chosen by each party from a roster, and the third panelist is selected by a party by lot. So the, I guess, just a quick word about the opportunity to challenge the Chapter 19 provisions under U.S. law. The provision was insulated from challenge and judicial review under the terms of the NAFTA, or under the terms, rather, of the implementing legislation. There's a significant financial disincentive to challenge the Chapter 19 process. Specifically, the implementing legislation requires any party filing a constitutional challenge to pay their opponent's litigation costs if the challenge is ultimately successful. There have been three constitutional challenges to Chapter 19 over the years, but they were either dismissed for jurisdictional grounds or settled and terminated. So there has never been a substantive decision by a U.S. court addressing the constitutionality of Chapter 19. So with that background and kind of overview on the provision and how it operates, let me talk for a few minutes about concerns that have been expressed about Chapter 19 and why it continues to be and attract a lot of negative attention from many commentators. And there are really three main issues or comments that have been raised in expressing concerns about Chapter 19. The first is an argument that it is inconsistent with the Appointments Clause of the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, which provides that the President, with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint officers of the United States. I think there's a fundamental concern that binational panelists are not appointed by the President or confirmed by the Senate, and thus do not have the power that would be vested in them as officers that are subject to nomination and confirmation by the Senate. Secondly, there's been a lot of commentary written suggesting that the Chapter 19 process is inconsistent with the Fifth Amendment's due process requirements. That you essentially have companies that are involved in unfair trade disputes involving either Canadian or Mexican products that are treated differently than companies that have disputes with imports from other non-NAFTA countries where jurisdiction and appeals under the U.S. federal courts would proceed. And finally, perhaps most straightforward, there's much commentary expressing concerns that the Chapter 19 process is inconsistent with Article 3, where you have the judicial power of the United States vested in the Supreme Court and such inferior courts as the Congress may establish. You have obviously lifetime tenure for federal judges during good behavior and the expectation of impartiality. With respect to Chapter 19, obviously you do not have lifetime tenure for panelists. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, many panelists are practitioners in the area and obviously would have interests that they have represented over the years and a potential for at least the appearance of conflicts of interest where you have practitioners sitting on panels and making decisions about how the laws should be interpreted. So finally, let me just say a few quick words about the Trump administration's positions on Chapter 19 and the NAFTA renegotiations. The fourth round of negotiations was concluded in mid-October here in Washington. It was actually quite a interesting negotiating round. The Trump administration tabled proposals on several items that were not well received by the Canadian and Mexican side. Some of those, if you may have been reading in the press lately, involved the establishment of a so-called sunset clause that would require a determination every 5 years on whether NAFTA should remain in effect. There were some controversial proposals modifying the rules of origin under NAFTA that are applicable to automobiles to require greater North American content and greater U.S. content. And relevant to our discussion today, as was long expected, the administration tabled a proposal to terminate Chapter 19. This was first signaled by the administration in mid-July when it put out a statement of its negotiating objectives for the NAFTA and very explicitly said that one of the administration's objectives was the elimination of the Chapter 19 dispute settlement mechanism. Not surprisingly, the Canadian and Mexican negotiators and officials from those governments have expressed strong concerns about the U.S. proposal, particularly the Canadians who originated this idea in connection with disputes where they thought that they received unfavorable decisions from U.S. courts involving softwood lumber. We can probably get into it more in the Q&A or at an appropriate time, but I would say there's not a real clear path forward on this, given some of the strenuous objections raised by the Canadian and Mexican officials. I think it will be difficult to find a fallback position, but it's certainly one where the Trump administration has laid out an aggressive position. And we'll have to wait and see how the negotiations come out in terms of the path forward. So why don't I stop there and pass off to Professor Santos.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to the Federalist Society for this invitation. And thank you, John, for your incredibly clear remarks and the background on Chapter 19. So what I'd like to do is respond briefly to some of the concerns you've raised about the constitutionality and policy implications of Chapter 19, and then also briefly mention some of the concerns with Chapter 11 and conclude with concerns about Chapter 20, so basically the dispute settlement chapters in NAFTA that I think could be good to have in the conversation, and I'm happy to address some questions if the audience wants to. In terms of the concerns about Chapter 19, what I'd like to do is to divide these concerns, broadly speaking, into the first one having to do with sort of some of the policy reasons for the existence of Chapter 19 and how it's worked, and then deal with some of the concerns that you raised about constitutionality. So in terms of the policy reasons, as you noted, we can trace back the existence of the chapter of some of the concerns that particularly the Canadian government had with the impartiality that some of the decisions concerning anti-dumping duties or countervailing duties were, whether those decisions were being done impartially for Canadian interests by U.S. agencies. And so there, I guess, we could also think about, okay, what's happened in the last 23 years that NAFTA has been into existence? And some analysts have proposed this idea that, in fact, if we look at the cases, NAFTA partners have imposed much less anti-dumping duties or countervailing duties on each other than what they have done on non-NAFTA trading partners. I'm thinking here of some of the work, for example, that Chad Bown from the Peterson Institute has put forward. And so this idea would lead us to think that, you know, in some ways, Chapter 19 perhaps has served as a deterrent for abuse of anti-doping and countervailing duties that are unjustified by national agencies. And if we look at the results of how cases have been decided by Chapter 19 panels, it seems that the results don't really look lopsided in terms of how the U.S., Mexico, and Canada have fared. And I can talk a little bit more about that. In terms of the, from a purely public international law perspective, of course, there's really not a question of sovereignty here in the sense that the three countries have agreed to establish this mechanism, and they have done that in full exercise of their sovereignty. So it's been a sovereign decision to consent to this review mechanism. In terms of the constitutionality concerns that you rightly noted, I would say, well, I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I would only note that it is a debate, and there's also arguments on the other side. So, for instance, William Davey, a well-known international trade law scholar, has put forward some arguments even when this was discussed in the Canadian-U.S. trade agreement, saying that the Chapter 19 of the U.S.-Canadian Free Trade Agreement did not violate a strict reading of the Appointments Clause. And even if it was a question, a close question under the Appointments Clause, there was ample precedent for finding them to be constitutional because of their connection with foreign affairs, which where the Supreme Court has traditionally been less concerned with separation of power. And so in some ways, I think it's important to note that, yes, there are constitutional concerns, but arguments can be made on both sides. And I guess my question to you, John, would be on this matter. If we could agree that there is a debate about the constitutionality and that it wouldn't be clear exactly what the result of a constitutionality review by a U.S. court would be, what would be your position in terms of the policy question? That is, do you think that from a consequence or results perspective, has this been good for the three member countries? Was it a good innovation in terms of a new settlement that no other treaty, in fact, has? Or do you think that its consequences have been negative and therefore it should be revised? This could also help us figure out whether there's room for improvement of Chapter 19 rather than just elimination. So, for example, is there something there that we can envision about improving the quality of the panelists, if that's a concern, or their standard of review that they're applying? Can we think of establishing a more permanent panel that wouldn't have the conflict of interest concerns that you noted? So, for instance, is there something to learn there from the WTO dispute settlement mechanism that we can think could be also done in NAFTA? So those are my comments and reactions to your really incisive remarks about Chapter 19. And then second, what I'd like to do is to move briefly to Chapter 11 and Chapter 20. So on Chapter 11, I think that there is also a very robust debate about the desirability of this mechanism. And the Trump administration has also, I think, suggested perhaps making that voluntary or even eliminating it. And there I have to say I'd like to note some of the concerns that have been raised, with some of which I agree. So the first one is that the level of protection to investors, to foreign investors, seems perhaps unwarranted. That is, that the level of protection is higher than the national treatment standard that is prevalent elsewhere in trade. So that means that countries have to treat foreign investors better than they treat their national investors. Their domestic investors don't have the recourse that foreign investors have to complain or challenge domestic regulations that affect their interests. There's also been an important work showing that this mechanism and the protections or the rights that have been given to investors can constrain the regulatory space or autonomy of states, and that sometimes these put corporate interests at odds with the public interests, particularly when states try to regulate in health or environment or sometimes even labor. And some of the concerns that you raised in Chapter 19 have also been raised here, so that the tribunals or the panels are ad hoc, are composed by private international lawyers who also often serve as litigators for investment disputes, and so there might be a potential for conflict of interest. There's also the question of how much these investors' protections help to attract foreign direct investment, which was one of the initial assumptions for having this framework in the first place. And the evidence there seems to be quite weak. That is, there seems to be no clear relationship between granting investors these rights in a framework like Chapter 11 or bilateral investment treaties and the actual flow of foreign direct investors. It turns out investors seek returns and there are many other things that are important to them apart from these protections. And that they can also insure themselves against potential risks by buying insurance or just assuming those risks at the cost of doing business. And I think here there are also emerging new models of investor protection, like, for example, the CETA, the treaty that Canada is negotiating with the European Union, where what they envision is a permanent tribunal that would deal with investment cases and also giving states more regulatory space. And so I think that there are emerging models that can be looked at by the NAFTA negotiators if they want to address some of these concerns. And finally, on Chapter 20, I think that this chapter needs to be improved dramatically, and I'm thinking here particularly of the difficulty of relying on the establishment of a panel. This was evident when Mexico requested the establishment of a panel to deal with a sugar dispute with the United States, and the United States simply declined to appoint panelists, and the panel was never established. And so I think that if parties could revamp this chapter 20, and again learn from particularly the experience of the WTO to make dispute settlement much more robust and be able to grant states the opportunity to bring their concerns and solve their disputes, that might be, I think, a step forward and something that I would imagine states would have an interest in doing. So I have other things in mind that I'd like to discuss, but I think I've said enough now about how these different dispute settlement mechanisms could be revisited in the renegotiation. Thanks.
Okay, great. Dan, would you like to have us open to audience questions?
Yeah, I think that sounds great. Why don't we throw it open to the audience now?
Wonderful. Well, everyone, in a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Dan, while our audience is considering any questions they might have, would you like to have a question for our speakers?
Yeah, sure. As people start to line up, I'd like to exercise the moderator's privilege. And I think the first question would be something to follow up on Professor Santa's comments. I'd be interested in hearing the speaker's thoughts as far as areas for improvement or kind of likely predictions as a result of the ongoing negotiations.
Alvaro, do you want to start us off or would you want me to start?
Sure, I can start. I'll start just by following up on this idea of Chapter 20, that it seems to me that would be a very good area of improvement and that I don't see how this could be to the detriment of any of the countries, on the contrary. On the other hand, I think that There's also been it's been observed how NAFTA has in many ways sort of lacked the institutional support that other trade agreements have had. And so I'm not saying that this would be an area for agreement of all countries, but it seems to me that this is an opportunity, that the renegotiation is an opportunity for the three countries to rethink how NAFTA has worked in these last two decades, and what are the institutional changes or improvements that they can do to strengthen it. And I think there are several areas where that can happen, including, for example, a stronger secretariat or staff that can keep some of these issues moving forward, so that NAFTA can be improved as new things come along, and that it's not only through dispute settlement where things are addressed, but more generally sort of including the concerns that countries might have. And the last thing I'd like to say, perhaps at a more general level, is that to me, this moment of renegotiation also presents an opportunity to rethink the rules of globalization. That is, that if we're really serious about the concerns that have been raised regarding trade and the rules of trade treaties more generally, both in the United States and in advanced countries, then we have a real opportunity to think about how these rules need to be rewritten. And my own research and my own interest here is there a path that would not simply be the continuation of international trade agreements as we know it, that is simply tweaking at the margins, or a move towards economic nationalism? In other words, is there an alternative to these two positions that seem to me the more dominant positions at the moment? And I think that NAFTA renegotiation is an opportunity to think about this and perhaps establish new rules that could help us model for other trade agreements as NAFTA originally served.
So let me offer a few thoughts, if I could, with respect to Chapter 19. I mean, I think it's given that Chapter 19, going back to the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, has been in place for, I guess, what, more than 20-some years now. Let's see, I guess closing in on 30 years, 27 yeah. years. It's hard, to my mind at least, to imagine the provision going away entirely, particularly given the intensity of the views, particularly with the Canadians, I believe, and to a lesser extent, although not a significantly lesser extent, with the Mexican government. So I guess from my perspective, it's hard for me to envision an outcome where the Trump administration's position of completely eliminating Chapter 19 is going to be agreeable to all three parties to the agreement. So given that, I think I guess two areas that I see that are ripe for possible renegotiation and modification are first the suggestion Alvaro made about how you identify panelists. I think given the fact that many panelists these days are practitioners and the potential conflicts of interest, that simply is not a good system. I mean, I think it makes sense to have individuals serving on panels who are familiar with the national law and administrative precedents that they're going to be look to be applying. But I guess from my personal perspective, at least, I think it would make sense to try to identify panelists who may not have some of the at least appearances of conflicts of interest that private sector practicing lawyers would have. I think the difficult part is identifying panelists who would serve, and you know, given that there are a limited number of disputes, it's hard to, for me to envision some sort of permanent roster of panelists like you might see at the WTO, but whether you might be able to get retired federal judges or retired state judges or retired practitioners perhaps, or individuals that are going to be more removed from the disputes that they are going to be asked to adjudicate. I think that would be a favorable development. The other thing that I would suggest is a possible area for improvement is the appeals process. As I talked about, under the current structure of Chapter 19, there is no meaningful right of appeal. Extraordinary challenge committees are extremely limited in their ability to review and influence panel decisions, and I think it would be important to beef up the provisions and the rights that parties would have to pursue appeals of panel decisions within Chapter 19. So those are my thoughts.
Looks like there are no current questions in the audience queue. Dan, is there something else you would like to ask our speakers?
Perhaps one last question before then we start to move to concluding remarks. I'd be interested in hearing if the speakers have any thoughts that they'd like to share in regard to the current issues with NAFTA and the current negotiations. How does that bode in regard to similar concerns in regard to the World Trade Organization, the WTO? The president's recently made some remarks publicly in regard to concerns that the United States has not been treated fairly by the WTO. And if we're going to see some of the issues come up in these negotiations in discussions regarding the future of the WTO.
So this is Alvaro. Before answering that question, Dan, I would just agree with what John said before on potential improvements for Chapter 19. I mean, I think that those are very sensible proposals and that it would be good to have a roster of panelists where the potential conflict of interest, even if it's not real, at least the appearance of conflict of interest would be removed. And thinking about retired federal judges or practitioners, I agree would be a good step forward if a permanent roster of panelists can't be introduced. And the same with the appeal process. What this would suggest is that we will be thinking of shoring up or strengthening the institutional aspects of NAFTA that I think have shown to be relatively amenable to improvement and currently not that strong. And so hopefully that's something that can be put on the table as a way to address the concerns that the U.S. currently has on Chapter 19. On your question about how the NAFTA discussion may translate or what can we infer from it to current declarations about the WTO, to be honest, I am not entirely sure. I think that maybe one way to think about this is that the current U.S. government is trying to change its trade policy in some ways, and that this type of public statement indicate a reconsideration of its existing position regarding trade policy, both on NAFTA and in the WTO. And so it's hard to say until we see more concrete proposals. But of course, these statements are a cause of concern. For instance, saying that the U.S. Might not be bound by the decisions of the WTO appellate body, or statements of that nature, of course, raise concern to some extent, in the other members. I think that in contrast to NAFTA, where the U.S. is basically the clear the member that has, in some ways, the more power, the more economic clout in the WTO because of its multilateral nature and its multipolarity, and because you also have there the EU and China and other Asian countries that are very strong economies, it might be much harder for the United States to influence the a change in the current regime that it's also not up for renegotiation in the way that NAFTA is. So I think there's an asymmetry that is clearer in the case of NAFTA, and WTO makes that more complicated. The last thing I want to say in regard to this question is that perhaps one of the things that we've observed in the current renegotiations is that there's a reluctance from the, I'm talking about NAFTA here, there's a reluctance from the governments of Canada and Mexico to accept some of the proposals of the United States, partly because it comes from a similar rhetoric of the United States has been treated unfairly and this has been incredibly positive for the other countries, or the other countries have cheated the United States. And I think that Mexico and Canada both disagree with that assumption, that they see that the U.S. has benefited from NAFTA, and at the same time, they also see some disadvantages that NAFTA has brought in their own countries. And so it seems to me that the rhetoric relies on an assumption that it's hard to accept for these other countries. There was a very interesting survey recently conducted by a research institute of the Mexican Senate, where the survey found that the majority of people in the United States, Canada, and Mexico believed that NAFTA had been good for their countries, that is, that it had had positive effects. But at the same time, in each country, the majority of people believed that the other countries had benefited to a greater extent than their own. And so it seems like this is a perception that is common in the three countries, and that some of the proposals that the United States is now putting forward are understood or interpreted as basically unilateral decisions of the United States that might not be in the benefit or to the benefit of the other countries. And since the agreement is trilateral and by definition would seek to benefit the three partners, when it's perceived as one-sided, the other countries will have a suspicion and probably a reluctance to accept those proposals because they don't go in their own interest.
From my perspective, I think that's a very good question, Dan, and it's one that's challenging to answer, but let me see if I can come up with a couple coherent thoughts to respond to you. I mean, I think anytime there's a decisions that go against the United States or go against a private party, I think there's always the temptation to look to the legitimacy of the authority of the panel or the decision-making body. And as Alvaro noted in his opening, the Chapter 19 process was agreed to by the United States in the context of the NAFTA negotiations. So, regardless of whether you think it was a good idea or a bad idea, the agreement is out there, and it is what it is, frankly, at this point. You know, that being said, are there opportunities to revise it or make it function more effectively? As we've talked about, I think there are. You know, I guess one thing I might put out is the importance of panels restricting themselves to the issues that are before them and the issues that they have authority to address. You know, with respect to WTO panel decisions, I think there's been a great deal of frustration and commentary in the United States where there's a perception that panels may have exceeded the scope of the negotiations in the Uruguay round with respect to zeroing or other issues like that. I think in order for panels and institutions to continue to have respect and compliance with their decisions, they need to be very careful about any decision or any perceived decision that exceeds the scope of their authority. So, you know, I think you're seeing similar concerns raised about panels at the WTO and about Chapter 19. I think that's, frankly, going to be inevitable. Losing parties are always going to look for reasons other than the substance of why they lost. And I think makes it all the more important that we do everything we can to ensure that panels are restricting themselves to issues that are before them and issues within their authority, removing any issues regarding bias or conflict or concern that panelists are doing anything other than reaching the best decision as they're able to with the issues that come before them.
Thank you very much for those two very thoughtful responses. I see that we're coming up on the closing of the hour. I was wondering if you'd be interested in providing us with maybe some concluding remarks.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, Dan, John, and the Federalist Society for this opportunity. I just before I conclude, I think I agree with John in what he said last, that panels should try to constrain themselves to the questions presented. And there what I would like to say, at least what I've observed in the WTO, is that part of what has happened is that we've had a really active dispute settlement system in the WTO, where there's been a lot of strategic litigation and interpretation of the agreements, where there have been gaps or room for interpretation, and at the same time, very limited advancement in the ministerial negotiations in trying to change or amend or move forward with the legislative branch, if you will, of the WTO. And so it seems to me that perhaps this can be a lesson for NAFTA, that is that you can't rely entirely on the dispute settlement for the agreement moving forward, and that just as we're now thinking that, you know, NAFTA needs to be modernized because 23 years ago there were types of trade that weren't really imagined or thought about or were really in its infancy and now can be included in NAFTA, the same would be for institutional concerns that need to be improved, and perhaps for things that could be dealt at the level of consensus by the parties without having to bring these issues to dispute settlement, in terms of clarifying the commitments and the agreements or making new concessions, so to make in some ways the agreement more flexible without relying entirely on the judicial branch or on the panels that settle disputes, and in that way making it less tempting for panels to set policy in judicial in judicial decision making, because there is an active operative branch at the level of the secretariat or the institutions of NAFTA that can deal with these issues. And so I think that that would be, for me, an ideal scenario and something that parties could now take advantage of as they're thinking of improving the treaty and rewriting those rules. I think that to conclude on the questions that we've discussed, I think that Chapter 19 has serious room for improvement to address some of the concerns that have been raised, not so much on the constitutionality, but on the potential room for conflict of interest in panelists, and also for, you know, the possibility of there being an appeal appeals instance for the decisions. I mean, this is something that John has introduced in our discussion and that I agree with. And then I think that Chapter 11 could also be drastically improved, that there are ways in which we've learned that the current balance of power is perhaps asymmetrical between capital and labor, and that there are ways in which this has become a concern in the United States and in Mexico, for sure. Canada as well has proposed a much more robust labor chapter in NAFTA, and that has to be paired with rethinking the protections of investors and how the dispute settlement in that chapter works. And so I think that, that there is serious opportunity for improvement there, and the same is true for Chapter 20. And we can learn from other treaties that the U.S. has been an active part of to improve what we currently have on NAFTA.
Sure. Let me offer just a few quick concluding thoughts, since I see we're up against the hour here. But, you know, I think we've had a very good discussion this afternoon. I guess, you know, what I would say is I think the Chapter 19 process was an accommodation that was made in the context of the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement and subsequently in the NAFTA that is highly unusual. I mean, I think it's fairly telling that you have not seen similar dispute settlement processes adopted in any of the subsequent free trade agreements that the United States has negotiated. And I think that says a little something about the operation and appearances with respect to Chapter 19. That said, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago in response to your first question, Dan, given that Chapter 19 has been around now for more than 25 years, I think it's difficult to envision the three parties to the NAFTA coming to an agreement to terminate it. I think we've raised a couple issues today in terms of potential modifications that could be considered in order to improve the functioning of Chapter 19 and perhaps remove some of the appearances of conflicts and some of the issues that have attracted negative commentary. I guess I'd just conclude with this thought. You know, I think the NAFTA has been a very important agreement, not only for the United States, but for Canada and Mexico as well, has led to important benefits for all three countries. And I hope very much that the negotiators are able to find a path forward on these issues and reach agreement that will allow a revised and strengthened NAFTA to emerge going forward. As I mentioned a couple minutes ago, obviously there are many other issues besides Chapter 19 that are sensitive and difficult. Obviously, the intent when these negotiations were launched was to conclude them by the end of this year. I think it's very clear now that that's not going to be possible. There are all kinds of political issues in Mexico and the United States and to a lesser extent in Canada that will present challenges next year. But I guess the bottom line I would suggest is I think this is far too important an agreement to rush these issues. I think the negotiations will need additional time, and I hope that all of the parties engage in good faith and look for ways to strengthen this important agreement going forward.
Well, thank you so much to both of our speakers. Wes, I didn't know if the Federalist Society had any closing notes before we adjourn.
Yes, I'd like to let all of our audience members know that our next scheduled teleform is on Monday, November 13th, and that will be on the North Korea conundrum. Please keep an eye out for these upcoming teleform calls, and you should find this teleform, as well as any of our previous ones, recorded on our website, where it's free for you to download. Dan, is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
No, I just thank our panelists one more time for their very thoughtful and insightful comments.
Wonderful. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. We are now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.